So how do you see aesthetic, ethical, religious A, religious B, for example, in your own kind of conception?
I see them, if you were to make a diagram, I see them as a point in a circle.
Yeah.
That you stand on the spot and you intensify the existence on the spot.
I see.
So it's not a movement in historical time.
Yeah.
And it's not even a movement through ontogenesis, through individual evolution.
Yeah.
You cannot transform existentially by going from Chicago to New York on a train.
Yeah.
Say you get a path through a certain trajectory.
Yeah.
So it's neither historical in a sense of stages of consciousness from archaic to magic to mythic and so on.
Yeah.
Nor ontogenetical for the individual who has passed them.
Yeah. And you know, if you do, let's say, start at ethical, well, let me ask, actually, if you come in at an ethical moment, and let's say you spent the last 10 years of your life at something that would be essentially an ethical disposition in the scheme, then if you shifted, could you shift to aesthetic for a decade?
You could shift downwards, obviously.
Yeah, that's very like trained states. It's very like, in a sense, the gross subtle causal, because you can come in at subtle and practice that, and you can downshift and practice gross.
And yet we know from Kierkegaard what allows for the changes from lower to higher or to all the way up. And he calls them collisions, existential collisions.
Yeah.
So while you cannot meditate yourself into it, you can reach a collision, dark night of the soul, or real life collision.
Yeah.
Where the mode of existence simply no longer gives answer to the mode of existence that you need to embody.
Yeah.
So they're like musical keys. I look at them, the stages, like in a musical scale.
Yeah.
They transpose the whole scale.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you put in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet we can see, and again, instantly, this is very much like, you know, trained states, because there is still, nonetheless, even though you can practice them almost in reverse, nonetheless, there is some sense to saying there's a progression.
Right.
And that when we list them as aesthetic, ethical, religious A, and religious B. We don't say the list is religious A, aesthetic, ethical, religious B.
Right.
And how do you see that general relationship of there being some sense of aesthetic to ethical to religious A to religious B?
Well, there is a hierarchy of intensity, and I think you describe it going on the mountain up.
Yeah.
Your consciousness increases.
Well,
the beginning of part two of Sickness Unto Death, Kierkegaard says, well, you can be a self before your cattle on a farm.
Yeah.
A very low order of the self.
Yeah.
But the self that is aware of itself before God has the greatest expansiveness of its awareness, of consciousness.
Right.
Because it knows its own despair as existing before God. And so sin consciousness and faith are like the opposite intensities. But he also admits that the aesthetical and the ethical are preserved in the religious. They are just integrally included as where they belong, as the answer they provide.
And let me ask you this, what your opinion on this is, because this also is pretty interesting in terms of just seeing what the relationship is. There are two types, well, there are many types, but there are in particular sort of two types of inclusion or even integral inclusion that we can talk about. And when it comes to just sort of pure structures and pure states, you see pretty pure forms of these two types, even though it's still kind of an ideal definition. But one type of inclusion is sort of the atoms, molecules, cells, organisms. There's literally an internal enveloping.
Right.
So that one really does, in some cases, physically transcend and include.
Right.
And then one is actually almost components of the other.
Right.
But then the other one that we see with trained states especially, it's that consciousness itself is just including these things that otherwise stay pretty much separate and even exclusionary. So what happens in states, waking, dreaming, deep sleep, for example, is even fully enlightened Buddhas still wake, dream, and sleep. It's not that when you reach non-dual, you stop having dreaming and deep form of sleep, and then it's just all, there's just one state that includes all these other states.
Right.
But with structures, there is. Whenever you're at a highest structure, whenever you're at formal operational cognition, you have pre-operational images and symbols and concrete operations. Those are all taken up and are internal to your formal operational cognition.
Well, since Kierkegaard was so opposed to the Hegelian developmental logic, the argument, I mean, he's quite adamant about the fact that the existential transformation is not occasioned by prior development. So it's not psychological. Like, if you eat well, you know, you will develop a certain kind of body. It just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
He even says, not being sick is simply not the same as not being sick. Not being in despair is not the same way as not being in despair. One has to actually freely reject despair as a possibility for oneself.
Yeah.
It does not happen through cell growth or psychological growth or historical education. So I think this is what Freud discovered as well, I think, under repression, that you can talk and talk and talk to somebody but who does not want to change, who will do everything not to be aware.
Yeah.
And you have to get around it. And so I think the stages of existence then proceeds according to these collisions rather than through inclusion. They proceed through disjunction. They're disjunctive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though once you go through the disjunct, there is something preserved from the previous, but it's preserved. It's wholly restructured or reintegrated.
Yeah.
It's sort of like your little picture on the website for the Institute.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it, for the multiplex. Yeah.
The whole self dies and is reborn each time in the collision. So I think that's the model.
And so let's say if you are predominantly, for Kierkegaard, let's say you're predominantly religious A at this point, and have not really had any fundamental experience of religious B, but you have had fundamental experience and have operated at ethical and aesthetic.
Right.
And then instead of being religious A, for whatever reason, you sort of throw that over and go back to being ethical. The one thing we do know is that there's a less intensity of consciousness brought to that mode now.
Well,
is that correct?
One reason one would do it is if one could not live with certain kind of religious pluralism.
Yeah, or stand the intensity.
Certain kind of openness of faith existence, then fundamentalism is a kind of low moral model.
Right.
Religious, and maybe even premoral when it becomes violent.
Right.
But it's an emphasis on doctrine and on principles and on adherence rather than inherence.
Right.
In cosmos.
Right.
So I think living with that kind of open anxiety of religiousness, without commitment to higher order awareness, can be very difficult and suicidal, and, you know, just that's the modern, well, that's what Heidegger, I think, developed, religiousness A, in Being and Time. I mean.
Uh-huh. And before I pursue that, let me finish this one line. So, and likewise, one, for various reasons, might not be able to stand the degree of intensity that ethical itself has, and one might simply retreat, as it were, to an aesthetic life.
Yes.
It's possible.
Certain crisis of commitment
in
marriage or commitment to citizenship or...
Right.
All those vocational spheres are ethical spheres, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Those duties, civic duties and personal duties and vocation. And
right.
But the strange thing is that from outside, because we can't see into inwardness of another, the aesthete and the religious might look very similar.
Yeah.
The religiousness B and the aesthetical might look irresponsible. So, like the case of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, he might just be a nut.
Yeah. Well, first, that makes a lot of sense to me. And one of the reasons I'm sort of asking these kinds of questions is it's related to that two types of inclusion. And that one kind of inclusion where it's sort of an enveloping inclusion is something that we find that most structures of consciousness really do sort of transcend and include their predecessor. And largely under those circumstances, the previous ones often just don't even really exist anymore. And that's not what's happening here, where unlike states and trained states, they do exist and sometimes still remain disjunctive and even exclusionary. But what's happening is the actual self or consciousness or the soul that is able to hold more and more of these other separate modes.
Right.
So that's where the inclusion comes. It's not that, let's say, the actual structure of religious B enfolds the actual structure of religious A, and that enfolds the actual structure of ethical, which enfolds the actual structure of aesthetic. It's that the religious B person can hold all four of these disjunctive modes and has access to all of them. And in some sense, has integrated them.
Well, I think when there is a practice of certain kind of existence through repeated acts of freedom, you know, one can stabilize. One would think that you could stabilize certain achievement without having to regress. Even though I don't think that it would cease to be freedom if it became automatic plateau.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and also would take it out of the realm of will.
Yes, and so I think the saint has the demonic temptation. I mean, those are the intensities.
Yeah.
And the SD doesn't have enough intensity to be demonic, really. For Kierkegaard, you know.
Yeah.
That's why he says, you know, to be able to sin, one has to be more developed self.
Yeah. Now, what's your sense about some of the strands of the different meanings of the word religious, and then also, of course, what he's, you know, what's actually therefore being meant when he discusses some of these things. But what's your sense about, you know, the sort of mythic, concrete, literal religiousness how do you see all that versus, I mean, other guys? Because he clearly doesn't have in mind when he says, you know, standing before God, that even though he'll use a lot of biblical references, he doesn't mean standing before that, you know, a mythic concrete literalness. And in some cases, he almost seems like he does. What's your sense about his understanding?
I think there is a shift from kind of a literal to doctrinal or orthodox to post-conventional religiosity. And I think the fact that already one of his pseudonym, you know, in the postscript and in the philosophical fragments, Clement says that you cannot go back to some kind of historical Jesus to resolve this question of faith is rejection of a literalist approach. And so I think the stages give you a shift in the types of religiosity. So in that sense, he has a normative, I think, the highest sphere of existence is normative in some sense, you know, over against the others. So he can say there are no Christians in Christendom, something like that.
Yeah. But wait, let me make sure I understand that. When you say that he's talking about shift in meanings of religiosity with the stages, do you also mean in his own life? Presumably he went through these stages himself, and more or less actually in this order, even though you don't have to. Isn't that your sense about?
He says that he was educated by divine providence through his own writing,
Yeah. So we'll take that to mean yes. But don't you get something higher in his own spiritual understanding than sort of the merely normative?
You get post-conventional, I think. You get the sense of the religious that transcends belonging to a particular church, community, or tradition, even though he belongs. I mean, that's his model. He has Lutheran church.
Yeah.
But I think he's quite post-conventional in the way he allows for things to be embodied. So in that sense, it's higher. And I had a graduate student who wrote a dissertation on Kierkegaard and the Kyoto School, the Japanese Buddhist school, and sort of wrote about a mystical dimension of Kierkegaard's authorship. So he claims, there is this dimension that's pluralistic and open and highly post-conventional.
What's your sense about Kierkegaard's own pursuing that in terms of his actual depth of a mystical, or in the sense of contemplative, series of understanding or awareness? Because, again, it doesn't seem, or the graduate student that was comparing it with, was it the Pure Land School or the Nichiren?
No, it was Nishitani.
The Nichiren, yeah. That's the most, you know, the most prevalent other power school, I believe, of Buddhism.
Right.
Which is very, very extremely influential in the Far East. Not so much in America, who only knows about self-power or Zen. But other power, even D.T. Suzuki said that more people got more enlightenment through the other power schools than through self-power. So it's extremely influential. But that's also deeply mystical in the sense that there is a divine union, or even at the intersection point, a divine supreme identity between soul and God in Godhead.
Right.
And what's your sense about, because Kierkegaard is also very, you know, intent on also keeping the importance of a certain kind of tension.
Yes, he wants to
can't really obliterate that, because that's another kind of false consciousness. So what's your sense on where he finally came down?
Well, I think there is a progression towards the full intensity of the self before God, and yet the self discovers it's nothing before God.
Yeah.
And he keeps that tension. I think there is that other discovery of nothingness before God and thorough simplicity.
Yeah. Well, I don't recall, and I don't know if there was any, where did he stand in relation to, let's say, Meister Eckhart's teaching?
Well, there are other people who are more knowledgeable than me, and that there have been comparisons done on Kierkegaard, Eckhart, Heidegger.
Yeah, Kierkegaard and Eckhart, what's your...
I would have to dig it up.
I have to dig it up.
I don't want to speak out of my
head. I understand. Do you think that his understanding of the nothingness as the, let's say, unqualifiability, ultimately, of God would also be part of just the sheer mystery of existence and of God's existence also would be a very powerful concept?
Yes, I would think so. Well, It comes in Kierkegaard under providence of governance, the fact that, you know, he had no clue what his authorship is going to end up, that it's this service or vocation that he had to his city, to Copenhagen and others, right?
Yeah.
So it's the utter mystery of the guidance in his life.
It's very rare that you have basically, you know, an individual, in this case Kierkegaard, that just almost single-handedly comes in and gives just such a utterly unique and compelling and powerful presentation, both positive presentation in terms of his own work and critique in terms of critique of some of the idealists. As Kierkegaard, I mean, he's quite extraordinary, historically, very rare. And he really had an amazing impact and continues to as, you know, one of the almost solitary voices for something that just won't go away.
Right. Mm. I think it's very important in the context of the type of religiosity, you know, that's around us to have those voices, I think.
Say more about that.
Well, I think his type of Christianity certainly is incompatible with forms of nationalism that he criticized in his own day.
Yep.
Or certain kind of, you know, herd religiosity. And yet it's a religious criticism. So here you have a religious criticism of certain kind of inauthentic form of religiosity.
Yeah.
We need, I think, a lot of that in the public sphere. I mean, in Christianity as well as, I think, equivalent of that in other forms of religions.
Yeah.
Because that's the danger today, this kind of stage of consciousness and sphere of existence that amalgamate together. Produce these clashes of civilizations, which are really not clashes of civilization, I claim, but clashes of stages of consciousness and states.
Yeah, I agree.
Existence, right.
I agree. Well, that's important too, isn't it? I mean, that topic right there, you know, if you want to, you know, knock out a few pages on that, would be something we'd love to publish as well. Yeah, I think that stuff is extremely important.
I think so. I think that's what needs to be spoken. That's where the responsibility for religious leaders is today, or people who work, who have some awareness to speak out and write and make this known.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also something that would be fun to specifically have a conversation with you about as well sometime. And, you know, not at the end of a three-hour conversation, but just start out sometime and just discuss that. I think would be really, really fascinating.
Well, if there's an opportunity, you know, for some presentation or workshop.
Okay. We can just that for sure.
You know, I'll think about, you know, coming up.
Okay.
The best, easiest thing to do probably just to come over and do that.
That would be great. And we could also just, you know, fly you out here for a day's conversation, just hanging out anyway. You and your wife.
That would be great. With or without presentation, you know, that doesn't matter, you know.
No, that's what I'm saying. We don't necessarily have to do, we would do, in effect, do something anyway, just like we're doing now, because, I mean, you just you know, put, you know, any of us together that are on this call, for example, we're just going to start talking about this stuff anyway. So, and then you just basically invite anybody who wants to come listen, and you've got a workshop. Now, hard to think of somebody that's had more influence in the modern, postmodern era. There are a handful, but certainly Heidegger stands huge. And Heidegger, by his own account, was attempting to sort of synthesize, bring together Dilthey, Nietzsche, and Kierkegaard. How sort of damaging to the, just sort of some of these general themes, some of the general existential themes, has Heidegger's essential sympathy with National Socialism? What's your own personal reflection on that?
I have reflections. My wife is a really specialist, more on Heidegger than I am, so that's like her area more. But I have thoughts on it myself, and I think rather than beating up on the guy, I think he's a great case for the study of our own vulnerability to this kind of failure, because he's certainly not the only one. I mean, the entire leftist tradition has the same problem in its figures, and you know, late Mihailo Markovic in Yugoslavia, you know, became advisor to President Milosevic, and I mean, these people who were very enlightened and critical suddenly fail somewhere historically.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably a case of how one can fall back in the spheres of existence to the aesthetical, how the temptation can work.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think combined with the quadrant analysis is a very good way of looking at it. And it was pretty unrepentant, as you know, for Heidegger, and that was Habermas's criticism, which I always thought was fair, which was that, you know, we can't really criticize anybody for getting, you know, involved with National Socialism at the beginning, because we don't know, first of all, how we ourselves would do.
Right.
And, of course, it really seemed just a pretty standard, straightforward political movement at the time. He said, but what Habermas himself found so difficult was the fact that after the event, Heidegger wouldn't say, you know, oops, sorry. And
it's that article that Habermas published, the essay in the opening pages of Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung in 1953, right? Thing with Heidegger against Heidegger, and he did it like 1 year before he defended his PhD, so it was really, really risky thing to do.
Right. But, you know, as you were saying, so many people got swept up in it, and Carl Jung, lesser known, but rather just as vigorously, got involved, and he really, there's no question, he saw it as a way to sort of advance his own interests, and that the Jewish collective unconscious, you know, he could use the concepts of his analytic psychology basically to do that. And so there's, you know, plenty of kind of ugliness to go around on this. But I was also just asking, it's just sort of your brief response in terms of, it seems to me, just looking at it, not saying whether he was right or wrong, but just looking at the impact, is that it's just really had a really strongly negative impact in terms of the acceptability of some of these ideas to the postmodern world.
Yeah, it certainly did, and but I still think it's a case for self-analysis.
Yeah.
And sort of.
Oh, I agree with that.
And we don't really know what Heidegger's silence was about, you know.
Yeah, very true. Let me then briefly mention the Aurobindo thing, and then I think we probably
need to end.
Yeah, need to wind down. It's just that it's another kind of these dimensions that one can look at when we're looking at basically the inward modes of awareness that the individuals have, and certainly one of them well described in terms of vertical structure stages,
right.
And some of them are well described in terms of what we kind of horizontal states and horizontal trained state stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're looking at another possibility of basically an existential sphere, transversal dimension.
Right.
And related to the latter, I think, is the Aurobindo notion. Aurobindo had two basic components. One was pretty straightforward vertical structure stages.
Mm-hmm.
And those are pretty straightforward. And, above the formal mind, he had the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the over mind, the super mind, and then Satchitananda. But there was also then in a sense, a horizontal, or what they sometimes call concentric system. And that was indeed this sort of an outer being, an inner being, and a central being.
Mm-hmm.
And the outer being was very much kind of aesthetic orientation, very similar to that. And then the inward being was, it almost sort of two parts to that, but one version of it is looking inward, but starting with it would be an ethical disposition.
Mm-hmm.
And then deeper than that was the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
So very close to aesthetic, ethical, spiritual was his outer, inner, and central. And the other thing about that is that that's a kind of awakening process that can occur at any of the vertical stages.
So how would you be able to put it into that chart, if at all?
Well,
would it be like something emerging through the space, or would it be like a sphere enveloping the states and stages?
What I've done is, I think that what Aurobindo is talking about, and this makes it a little bit different than what you're talking about, so I'm not necessarily saying that they overlap, it's just that whenever you see these things, you can learn a lot by comparing and contrasting them. I actually see, if you draw, you can use the chakra system, you use the seven chakras, and what you can have is at each of these seven vertical structure stages, there is, in a sense, a series of three or four, depending on how many you want to count, of these states of consciousness that are gross, subtle, causal, non-dual. And in addition to that is the self's relation to those states.
Mm-hmm.
And that is its actual translational orientation. And that's what Aurobindo was talking about.
That's the key. So to that horizontal sphere at the bottom, you add a double line or the second line or something.
Something like that, exactly.
Like a key, like a musical key.
Exactly.
Because you have to transpose these in some way.
That's right. It's just, and it's the self's relation to these. The self can identify with them or not. And so, again, they can tend to unfold in that one particular direction, outer, inner, central, but you can be at the inner or inward orientation and go back to the outward.
Right.
And so on like that. So it's not a rigid stage sequence at all. And yet it's also marked by increasing degrees of intensity. But I like it because what it says, these can be awakened at any of the vertical stages. But
that's right, because they have to be. It has to be applicable for every generation. Every individual in every generation, and yet it
starts at square one.
And yet it has to be different, you know, being ethical and rational stage is different than being ethical in the magic or integral stage, right?
So. Yeah, yep. And that's why the outer and inner and central also can be different, because something is different, but they also, everybody starts at square one.
Wow, yeah.
And so that's very interesting. And what I particularly liked about it is it's a very nuanced conception that he had, and you'll see in my book Transformations how, you know, what I've done with it, and of course I've, you know, brought some of my own viewpoints to it. But Aurobindo was the first person that I've seen who really went into this, and what I like about it is he basically, what he's saying is that you can go ahead and be moving through these vertical stages, and you can actually be getting pretty high, but you can still be stuck in an outward orientation. You really have to have an inward awakening.
That's
if
right.
You're going to get the richness of it.
That's right. I mean, you could have a contemplative state, and you could be at a higher level of stage of consciousness, and yet somehow not be integrated in yourself.
Basically.
Yeah.
Because this one, it does have to do with the self and your relation to structure and your relation to states.
That's right. I think it's the organizing principle in the end for the integral spirituality is the self.
Definitely. And the self is, like I said, something that, you know, I haven't written as much on because I've emphasized some of these other things. But the self, to me, is actually really, really central. And if I sometimes have to give a quick summary of the three components that integral psychology needs, I just call it ladder, climber, view.
Right.
And the climber is the self. And it's absolutely central. All of the action in integral psychology is probably the one book I go into the self the most. And people have quoted me there because I say the self is where the action is.
Well,
and it is where the action is. And so there's structures and there's states, but then there's whether you identify with them and whether there are shadow elements. And the self has a state identity and it has a structure identity, but it has its own organizational capacity, and I also call that the translational orientation, how it's actually going to translate these things that are given to it. And so itself is where the action's at, and I think there's a component of what you're talking about in this existential sphere that is really keying fundamentally on the self's orientation to its being in the world.
I think that's another contribution of the West.
I agree. Right on the money.
The Judeo-Christian sort of
part.
I don't know how much Islam played into it, but certainly I think it's a key to undoing certain damaging forms of religiosity, as well as the conflict between the secular and sacred.
Mm-hmm. And then we have to complexify that by pointing out, you know, just the very least when it comes to the sacred. There's pre-rational, rational, and trans-rational sacreds.
That's right.
Boy, are some of those night and day.
Yeah, well, I think that's what the conflicts are. We basically misunderstand the conflicts when we don't understand these relations.
I agree. And that's a disaster of the first magnitude. And that, in a slightly more reasonable world, and it's certainly, I think, much more so in Europe, but that ought to be the role of the scholar and the academician and the intellectual in the positive sense in terms of helping to inform public and political debate.
That's right.
That ought to be our job in society.
Teachers, religious leaders, intellectuals, I mean, everybody who is enlightened, I mean, this is where the battle is, to translate these conflicts.
Yeah.
Find religious language that can actually speak to kind of a pre-conventional or hardened religious consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
To find a language that can open up the secular consciousness to understand the higher form of religious life as possible and good, and so on. I mean, I think that's where the battle is, I think.
Yeah.
If I could convince Habermas, you know, to actually go that direction, that would be great, or people around him.
Well, it certainly would, and the point that you're raising, it's a beautiful point, and probably a beautiful point for us to wind down this part of the discussion, but let's definitely, you know, keep in mind, indeed, having Habermas, if it's one of those, you know, because he's getting quite on in age,
yes.
This is clearly, if I had to point to just one single gaping problem, this is a major problem in him. This would be it. And that's he doesn't understand the varieties of religious.
But he has been studying religion last about, 5 years at least. He has some manuscript on it. So he simply is preoccupied.
Well, and at the very least, if somebody just handed him a copy of Integral Spirituality.
Send him a copy. I have one from Shambhala, the early copy. So
we've got a cleaned up version. We'll get him the book's actually published. But even more so, they're very quickly translating into German as we speak. So we can get him a copy in German too. Although I know he's quite fluent in English. But
maybe I will write a kind of review article, and that might help.
That would be great.
Something like that.
Okay. Well, let's you and I talk about that. When we see each other, talk again, or have you down here, whatever we do, and that'll just be something kind of an ongoing thing we can discuss.
This has been really exciting. It has been a real pleasure, joy, and you have my gratitude for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. It's just wonderful, and I look forward to meeting your wife and continuing our discussions.
Great.
Awesome.